This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Good evening. I'm Russell Banks. A courageous writer is one who takes him or herself to a place that's unsafe at any speed, a place where he or she doesn't want to go, and carries a reader, a perfect stranger. And a reader for a novelist is the perfect stranger, along for the ride. So that when we read Marlon James, we have to hold on for dear life, or we'll fall off his broad back and find ourselves more or less where we were when we first opened his book, scared and alone and mystified by our life and the lives of others, or merely ignorant of our life and the lives of others. For he is a brave writer, and to read him right, we must be brave too. His language, for starters, is a riptide that threatens to carry us further out to sea than we've ever been before. As in the opening sentences of James's second novel, The Book of Night Women. People think blood red, but blood don't got no color. Not when blood washed the floor, she lying on as she screamed for that son of a bitch to come, the lone baby of 1785. Not when the baby washing crimson and squealing like it just depart heaven to come to hell, another place of red. Not when the midwife know that the mother shed too much blood and she who don't reach 14th birthday yet speak curse upon the child and the papa, and then she drop down dead like old horse. Not when blood spurt from the skin or spring from the axe, the cat of nine tail, the whip, the cane, and the blackjack, and every day in slave life is a day the color red. It soon come to pass when red no different from white or blue or black or nothing. One almost has to go back to the moment when first opening the pages of Faulkner or Toni Morrison or Cormac McCarthy for that kind of linguistic slap upside the head. It's not just the rich, loamy texture of the prose or the forward lunging speed of the syntax or the confident, authoritative naming of the things that fill the fictional world we're about to enter. There's something that's fresh and new in American literature here, that is both instantly familiar, i.e. of the family, been sitting around the fire with us forever, and just brought in from the cold outside. There's heard here something we needed and didn't quite know we needed. I'm speaking, of course, of the infusion of Afro-Caribbean spoken English. I might better say transfusion than infusion. Fresh blood, without which constant ongoing transfusions, American English literature would have died in the early 19th century, pale and thin and laid out on a fainting couch. And then there is the range of his characters. He's no niche writer with the residence of a county or a village or even a country that he's claimed as his own. He's as inclusive and multiracial and multicultural as we'd like our nation to be. Although he has said in interviews that Jamaica is always at his back, it's at his back, which is as it should be for an American artist. Our origins may aim us, but at a target that's always elsewhere and moving. I'm making a claim here that Marlon James is an American novelist. I hope he doesn't feel appropriated. He may be the first Jamaican-born writer to win the coveted Booker Prize, as he did in 2015 with his third novel, A Brief History of Seven Killings. But I like to note that it was only after the Booker Committee decided to let the Americans compete. And that prize, of course, made him a world novelist, where the universality of his characters and the myths that shape their lives and his imagination can be recognized and internalized by any reader in any language. A few words about the structure of his novels, especially A Brief History of Seven Killings. Back in the 1980s, practically without anyone noticing, the structural conventions of what we call novels began to shift. The old Jamesian principle, that's Henry James, not Marlon James, the old Jamesian principle that a novel needed to have a single consciousness at its center, pretty much a Western European principle going back to the ancient Greeks, so that central consciousness usually ended up belonging to a man, a white man. A significant number of writers produced novels that spread the central consciousness around more democratically, one might say. I'm thinking of writers like Gloria Naylor, Louise Erdrich, Toni Morrison, John Edgar Wideman. They de-radicalized the notion of collage narration, in the process reconfiguring our expectations of plot, normalizing multiple points of view as a way of telling a tale, to the point where it has become a not uncommon mode of storytelling, even for films and television. Marlon James has extended that de-radicalization and reconfiguration even further. I hope and expect that younger writers will take courage from his achievement and push it still further until a big, bad, bold story can be told from multiple characters' points of view in many places and points in time, making for us a new physics of narrative that is finally caught up to the space-time continuum of our physical reality. There is much, much more to say about the work of Marlon James, and I'm sure that we will get to some of it in our conversation later. So let me simply close by saying what a deep pleasure it is to be able to introduce him to you tonight, and an honor to be able to share this stage with him.
Thank you. Thanks to Lennon for bringing me out, and thanks to Russell for that fantastic introduction, which will now become my next blurb. Forget the title of the next book, it will just be the blurb going on the whole page, the whole cover and back cover. So I'm going to read some sections from my last novel, A Brief History of Seven Killings. The funny thing about this novel, I'll tell you a secret that my publisher doesn't want you to know, is that it's actually a longer book. It says 688 pages, but I'm sure when you were reading it, you're like, I know exactly where a 600-page novel ends, and I'm still reading this. We may have decreased the margin size, but that's all I'm going to say. We may have reduced the font. Maybe. The funny thing about, and the reason why I bring this up and I'm talking about length so much is that this actually started out as my shortest novel. And those of you if you familiar with the book, the very first paragraph, the very first scene I ever wrote is now on page 458. Because it started out as a sort of, you know, when I began writing this book, I was reading a lot of crime fiction at the time. And I'm always reading crime fiction. It's probably my favorite genre other than sci-fi. And I was reading all these short novels, you know, all the great Jim Thompson novels, a lot of French guys, Jean-Claude Izzo, Jean-Patrick Manchette. I'm like, I'm going to write a 120-page book or a 130-page novel and just get it out of the way. And 688 pages later. And another thing I make sure not to point out too much to people is that even though it's a brief history of seven killings, there were eight killers. But killing number eight would be another 400 pages, and I don't think we want that. So I'm going to read, there are many characters in this book, so I'm going to be jumping all over. But I think what I'll do is do a set of readings that's set in Jamaica and a set of readings that's set, passages that's set in the United States in the 80s and 90s. One thing that most of the characters in the first section of the book are doing, the one thing they all have in common is in one way or another, they're watching Bob Marley. So the main character, so one of the characters is Nina Burgess. And Nina is a person who is convinced that Bob Marley's song Midnight Ravers is about her. And she's going to use that as a means to get him to notice her and give her some money because she's trying to leave Jamaica. She didn't qualify for a visa because she can't prove she has any ties to the country because she doesn't. And but somebody told her they can get her a fake visa. So she has to get the money. So this is her sort of standing, sort of stalking Bob Marley, actually. 17 buses, 10 minibuses, 21 taxis, 376 cars, I think. And not once did the man step out of his house, not even to get some air, not to make sure that the guards are doing their job, not even to tell the son, later, my brethren, I'm going to have serious work to do. Danny's watch still works, and it wasn't until lunch one time at the Terra Nova when I ran into a former schoolmate. Her breasts drooped down like a tired goat, but still a stuck-up bitch, that I found out Timex is the same watch that her father gave the helper for 15 years of service to the household. This bitch was calling me cheap. I wanted to tell her how happy she must be as a married woman, now that she no longer has to bother with looking attractive. But I smiled and said, I hope your little boy can swim because I just saw him running to the pool. I wish they would invent phones that you can take with you. Or I would have called Kimmy and asked her if she's gone to see her poor mother and father yet. And what are we going to do about leaving this country before something worse happens? Knowing Kimmy, she probably finally showed up in her Ganja University t-shirt and jeans, the one cut halfway down the backside, calling mommy her sistren and saying, this is all the plan of the Babylon shit stem, and it's not the robber they should be mad at, but the shit stem that robbed them first. That's what they say at the 12 Tribes meeting place in that rough and tumble neighborhood called West King's House near the home of the Queen's representative. I really need to get better at sarcasm. I might be a snob, but at least I'm not a hypocrite. Still coasting around because I have nothing to do now that my life's dream to breed for Che Guevara blew up in my face. Nor am I hanging out with rich people in West King's House who don't wash their hair and are calling themselves Rasta to upset their parents when everybody knows in 2 years they're going right back to their father's shipping company to take it over and marry whichever Syrian bitch just wins Miss Jamaica. Car 367, 68, 69, 70, 71, 72, I need to go home. But I'm outside here, waiting on him. You ever feel like home is the one place you can't go back to? It's like you promised yourself when you got out of bed and combed your hair that this evening, when I get back, I will be a different woman in a new place. And now you can't go back, because the house expects something from you. A bus stops and I fan it off. The bass creeps up from across the road. It sounds like he's been playing the same song all day. It sounds like another song about me, but there are probably 24 women in Jamaica right now and another 2,000 in the world who think the same thing anytime a song of his come on the radio. But Midnight Ravers is about me. One day, I'm going to tell Kimmy, and she'll know, won't she, that just because she's the prettiest doesn't mean she gets all of them. A police car with blue stripes going all around it park itself by the gate. I didn't see it coming. Jamaican police tend to use their sirens all the time, just to get people to clear the street so they can reach Kentucky Fried Chicken quicker. I never have dealings with the police. One of the guard over the gate is telling the police right at this minute that I've been at the bus stop all day watching the house. But instead, somebody says something, and the fat policeman, there's always one, laughs, and it echoes all the way over to this side. He leaves to get back in his car, but somebody from inside shouts at him, I know it's you. It has to be you. A car coming in on my side of the road, 90 feet? I can beat it before it slams into me. I just know it. The car, 40 feet? Run right now. Don't blow your horn at me, you son of a bitch. I'm in the middle of the road. I'm in the median. Too many cars driving down on the other side of the road. And me, I'm in the middle, maroon like Ben Gunn. And I just want you to see me. It's you. It must be you. Remember me? Midnight Ravers is about me, even though it was after midnight and you might not know what I look like in the day. and I just want a favor. I just need a little help. They robbed my father. No, I don't know, but it's story sounds more urgent when somebody's getting robbed. And I know it's you, and the policeman is waiting. Good, good, good. He's coming outside. It's not you. Another guard runs outside to tell him something, and the fat policeman laughs again and deposits himself in the car. I'm stuck in the median, traffic blurring past me and lifting up my skirt. Hello, I'm here to... No visitors. On-site tour start next week. No, you don't understand. I'm not here for the tour. I'm here to see... He's expecting me. Ma'am, nobody coming through except immediate family and the band. You and wife? What? Of course not. What kind of person? You play an instrument? I don't see what that have to do with anything. Just tell him Nina Burgess is here to see him, and it's urgent. Lady, you could name Scooby-Doo. Nobody coming in the air. But, lady, step away from the gate. I'm pregnant, and it's for him, and I need to mind him pick me. The guard looked at me for the first time today. I thought he was going to recognize me until I realized he really was seeing me for the first time today. He looked me up and down, too, maybe wanting to see what type of woman it takes to breed for a star like him. You know how much woman come here since Monday saying the same damn thing you just said? Some of them even have belly to show me. Me say no visitors but family and band. Come back next week. Me sure the baby not running nowhere. Eddie, somebody at the gate, move them. Then after the woman don't want to move, then move her. I step back quick. I don't want none of these men touching me. They always grab onto ass or crotch first. Behind me, a car pulls up and a white man comes out. For a split second, I nearly shout, Danny, but this man is only white. His hair brown and long and a little beard on his chin, the way I used to like it, but Danny didn't. A yellow plain T-shirt and tight bell-bottom jeans. Maybe it's the hot weather why you can tell that, one, he's American, and two, American men hate underwear more than American women hate bras. Bumba clap, look here, Taffy, Jesus is risen. What, but men I repent yet? The white man didn't get the joke. I stepped out of the way, making too much of a show of it. Hey, buddy, Alex Pierce from Rolling Stone. Wait, then, no tight jeans, Jesus. Two men from Rolling Stone come here already. One named Keith and one named Mick, and none of them look like you. I'm from Rolling Stone magazine. We spoke on the phone. You never talked to me on no phone. I mean someone in the office, his secretary or something. I don't know. I'm from the magazine, from the U.S. We cover everybody from Led Zeppelin to Elton John. I don't understand. The secretary said December 3rd at 6 p.m. when he's on rehearsal. And here I am. Boss man, me doing him secretary. But look, we get strict orders. Nobody in or out except family and band. Oh, why does everybody have an automatic weapon? You guys police? You don't look like the security guards from last time. None of your damn business. You want to step off now. Eddie, who is that at the gate? Some man, him's about some magazine about lesbians and Elton John. No, Led Zeppelin. Tell him to move off. How about me make it easy for you? The man takes out his wallet. I only need 10 minutes, he says. Damn Americans, always thinking we're like them and everybody's up for sale. Just once, I'm glad the guard is such an asshole, but he's looking at the money. He's looking at it long. You can't help it with American money. Getting around the fact that this piece of paper is more valuable than everything else in your purse. That if you whip out one, you change the behavior of a whole room. It just doesn't seem right. A piece of paper with no color but green. Lord knows pretty money isn't the only thing that's worthless. The guard takes one last look at the piling bills and walks away, over to the entrance of the house. I chuckled. When you can't fight temptation, you have to flee, I say. The man looks at me annoyed. I just chuckle more. Doesn't happen every day. A Jamaican who doesn't turn into a yes, master, I go and get it for you, master, when he sees a white man. Danny used to be appalled by it until he started to like it. Hell of a thing when white skin is the ultimate passport. I was a little surprised at how good it felt, me and the white man both being kept outside like beggars. On the same level in that regard, at least. You'd think I've never been around white people, or at least Syrians who think they're white. you fly all the way from America just to do a story on the singer? Well, yeah, he's the biggest story right now. The number of stars coming out for this concert, you'd think it was Woodstock. Oh, Woodstock was, I know what Woodstock was. Oh, well, Jamaica is all over the news this year. New York Times just did a story that the Jamaican opposition leader was shot at, from the office of the prime minister, no less. Really? That would be news to the prime minister, since the opposition have no reason to be at his office. That's not what the newspaper said. Then it must be true, then. I guess if you write shit, then you have to believe every shit you read. Oh, come on, don't bust my balls like that. It's not like I'm a goddamn tourist. I know the real Jamaica. Good for you. I've lived there all my life, and I haven't found the real Jamaica yet. So I'm going to skip. I'm actually doing a relay thing. I'm jumping to this character, Alex Pierce, who we met in the previous scene, Tight Jeans Jesus. So this is him figuring out something is up. Not quite sure what it is. But, you know, in Jamaica in 1976, there was always a sense that something was about to boil over. The year started with this mysterious poison flower that ended up killing a few entire families early in the year. By the time we got to the end of the year, the ambassador for Peru was murdered. Henry Kissinger was in and out. And a bunch of things that was happening. So there was just this sense, even when you were, if you were just visiting, even if you just got there was a sense something was about to break. So Alex Pierce senses it. It's just that he's smart enough to sense that, but not smart enough to figure out what that is. So he keeps getting into trouble. So this is him. Gig like this got its own juice. I'm in Kingston, somewhere between Studio One and Black Ark, thinking there must be a reason why hippies have such a hard-on for this scene. I mean, a poor boy can do nothing but sing in a rock and roll band, but a rich boy, on the other hand, can stop cutting his hair, calling himself hippie along with some hairy armpit chicks, confuse having the means to tune in and drop out with a conviction to fucking do it, and call himself a Rastafarian. Then he goes off to St. Bart's, or Maui, or Negril, or Port Maria, sticking it to the man in between rum punches, always hated hippies. Worse, now you have rich bitch Jamaicans imitating hippies, imitating Rastas. What the fuck? But hey, it's Jamaica. At least everybody should be pumping some Big Ute and Jimmy Cliff. And yet when I get here, first time in a year, the only thing playing on the radio is more, more, more. How do you like it? How do you like it? And I'm thinking, this rep is bogus. I flip on another station and it's Ma Baker, She Knew How to Die. Switch to FM radio and it's Fly Robin Fly up to the Sky. I ask the busboy at the hotel, so where am I going to hear some Mighty Diamonds and Dillinger? He looks at me like I just asked to suck his dick and then says, not every Jamaican sell the Cali weed, sir. Even ABBA gets more play than reggae here. I've heard Dancing Queen so much, I can feel myself turning fag. I'm in Skyline, the hotel with a commanding view of the hotel in front. In Kingston, you go down the street and there's a black guy and a white guy and lots of mixed guys, and they're all at the same hotel, or at the singer's house, or just on the street. Even on TV, the weather guy is black. You see black people all the time in the States, but you don't really see them, certainly not reading the news. You hear them on the radio all the time, but once a song is over, they vanish. They're on TV, but only when somebody just acted like a jive turkey or somebody just made them say dynamite. Jamaica is different. A Jamaican is on TV. A white woman just won Miss World, but she's from here. She said that the singer is her boyfriend and she can't wait to go back to be with him. No shit. Some stone foxes live in this city and they can all dance. Out the window, even the traffic has music to it. In the resorts, Americans say bumper clat and think they're cooler because they got their head braided by a girl Friday. Not from the movie. This is some Robinson Crusoe black personal slave shit, no kidding. And they looked at me weird when I dropped my drink the first time I heard it. And I learned to talk like a real Jamaican man. People let it all hang out here. They move with a kind of swag, but nobody forgets their place. And if you talk to enough people in the hotel, you get the white tone. people being polite to a fault because that's how they were trained to talk to you. And because it's all about race, it fucks up all the time. One time, this black guy asked for the busboy to take his bags, and the boy just walked off. Guy started shouting, "This is some slavery-loving Uncle Tom bullshit right here," for them to realize he was American, and even then the boy asked to see his room key. Go out on the street, and it's the same thing until you walk far enough and the people get realer. Still, it's Jamaica, and this place is kind of ace. Serge Gainsbourg, the ugly French dude who keeps making cheesy records and scoring hot chicks, has a story. So he comes to Jamaica because he's heir to Doozy Reggae, and motherfuckers at the studio just laugh him off, right? Like, who the bumbaclat is like a French boy I think him is? Serge says, "But I am the biggest pop singer." They say, "We don't fucking know you. The only bumbaclat French song we know is Je T'aime." Serge says, "Je t'aime, that is me." Gainsbourg was a god after that. So I'm at Studio One and ask one of the men here if he could get me a cup of coffee, black no cream. He says, "What, your hand's sick? Get it your blood clot self." Classic, man. I'm supposed to be on Mick Jagger's tail, but nobody's going to call Black and Blue a misunderstood masterpiece. Not in 10 years and not in 20, and I said so. Fuck him and Keith anyway. And fuck Rolling Stone random nose gossip bullshit. I'm this close to getting the skinny on something big. Armageddon time, square biz. The busiest, most vital music scene in the world is about to blow up, and I don't mean the charts. The singer, he's up to something. It took putting in a few years uptown and downtown and some convincing to prove people that I wasn't some stupid white boy waiting for the limbo party for people to start talking to me. The Kingston sissy at the front desk doesn't even know who Don Drummond is. There's this too. Jamaicans are not just the ones working at the hotel, but brown and white men who are always drinking rum at the restaurant and when they see my camera, ask if I'm from Life magazine. Then tell me where not to go. If you go where they go, you end up at Ligany Club where it's fucking disco duck and boring rich bitches who just finished tennis and want to ball. I tell them, "I'm bailing for Turntable Club," and they look at me and wonder why I don't ask for directions because they know they wouldn't know. I asked the concierge just a few hours ago, "Where's the jam session?" He says, and I quote, and I kid thee not, "Sir, why you want to mingle with that element of society?" I was this close to saying, "Dude, suck a dick already, it's cool." But this story, it's something. So I'm in a taxi heading to the hotel, and the taxi driver asked me if I bet on horses. I'm not a betting man, but he is. And who did he see at the tracks a couple weeks ago? The singer. He was with two guys. One of them calls himself Papa Lo. I did some checking on this Papa Lo. Racketeering, extortion, 5 counts of murder, only one reaching trial and acquitted. Runs a shantytown called Copenhagen City. So here's a singer, along with two hoods from a political party he's not supposed to support, and they're hanging chummy like old school pals. The next few days, he's hanging out with Shatta Sheriff, the godfather of the 8 lanes, controlled by the other party, the other side. 2 top goons in 1 week. 2 men who pretty much control the fighting halves of downtown Kingston. Maybe he's just a peacemaker. I mean, he's just a singer. Thing is, I'm catching the drift that nobody else is ever just anything in Jamaica. Something's cooking and I'm already smelling it. Did I mention that there's an election in 2 weeks? So I'm going to move on. I'm going to one last scene in Jamaica and then we're going to hop the plane to New York. So, let me see if I can find it. I think I lost it again. Why do I keep losing it? This is after, you know, this is after the attempt on Bob Marley. This is some days after. The men have tried to kill him. They failed. And the person who was in charge of the hit is not having a good day. So this is him. Some things to know, Jam Intel Communications, back in the 70s, if you wanted to make an international call, most of the times you still had to go to the telecommunications office and have them place the call for you. So when you have the most dangerous man in Kingston still have to stand up in a line at this big phone office to take a call, you can imagine how pissed off he is. December 1976, the singer just did a concert, and I'm wasting time at fucking Jamintel Communications because I need to make an international phone call, only to hear Dr. Love and some idiot cursing out in Spanish, but not Cuban Spanish, so I didn't understand most of it, but I know he was mad. And I'm thinking, who the fuck this is thinking can talk to, as if I don't know what hijo de puta mean. Why do you think I was going to start cry and say, I'm so sorry, boss man. Next time I'll do it better, I promise. Was about to tell this maricon about his bumbleclad when Dr. Love said to me, just finish the job, muchacho. Just finish it. So the Jamaican Syrian, the Cuban, and the Colombian all want a body, yet none of them realize that I gave them something way better than a body. The same week, Peter Nasser from the government calls me with, what the bumper clock wrong with the whole of you fucking ghetto people? This is not the first time I hear you with your you people. I didn't say you people. I said you fucking ghetto people. What the bumper clock wrong with you? 9 man? 8. So 8 man storm into OK Corral with what? 14 guns? And not a single man could shoot straight? Man can shoot straight enough. How you managed to be the first man in history to shoot somebody in the head and not kill him? Answer that. I don't know who you mean by you, or are you so fool you think this phone can't tap? What does this look like, a spy movie? Who the rats would tap you? Even so, I don't know who you mean by you, but I'm sure him, whoever it is, didn't aim for anybody's head. He, whoever he is, didn't aim for nothing but wall and sky, it looked like. No, Busha, this kind of slackness and poppish are only happening in comedy. Imagine, hundreds of bullets, and they couldn't take out one fucking man. It's a fucking machine gun. How hard could it be to shoot? I thought Louis taught you people how to deal with these things. I don't know no Louis, and I sure you don't know no you people. Don't draw my tongue, Josie Wales. I told him, you know, don't make sense to try to teach these ghetto niggers anything that will take any kind of intelligence, because they're bound to fuck it up. My blind grandmother could have hit a target better than you. All 8 of you. I don't know why I even bothered to call you. I don't really know it either, since none of these people you're talking about live here. Why am I even running up my phone, Billy? Tell me. I don't know why. What? You know who you're talking to? You know who the bumper clock you're talking to? You little. You must drop your pants and look again. I hang up the phone. It's a bitch of a thing when you realize that though you're the only one who didn't go to a top-class school and foreign college, you're the only man in the room with sense. I really wanted to to educate this ignorant, bad-chatting Syrian shithouse, that is bad enough that plenty man and woman have the singer off as a prophet, but kill him and the man graduate to martyr. That way, the whole world know that, guess what? The prophet is just a man. And like any other man, he can get shot like any other man. And like any other man in this country, not even he's safe. I shoot that man off in pedestal and he fall back down to man size. I didn't tell Peter Nasser any of that. You have to look past the man, below the skin, the real skin, to know that for all the whiteness in the face of a man who didn't even go to the beach, so even his tan looks black, Peter Nasser is just another ignorant as shit nigga. But at least he calling me Busha these days. I must ask my woman when exactly I change into a white man who drink at Mayfair Hotel. I said to Dr. Love, who also called me that night, I done deal with proving things to people. If they really think this is prep school where they feel they must test and test, then Medellin can go right back to using those faggots in Bahamas. But then, to use Arrest's own words, I get hit with another reasoning. If the singer did turn into a martyr, it would be a big problem for me, sure, but it would be their problem, not mine. Peter Nasser would be so busy shitting himself trying to kill a legend, he wouldn't have time to bother me with this fuckery, because truth be told, what he and I know is long past the days when politicians say jump and I say how high. Now, when politicians jump, I say, my woman say he can't come to the phone right now, but he'll take a message. Talk about fool. What do you think? So I decided to let my mind work on this new reasoning. December 8, 1976, news just come out that he and everybody survive. Too much police at the hospital, and besides, by the time I grab another Tony Pavarotti, because Weeper was not the man for this kind of kill, the emergency room said treat him and send him home. Only the manager was in the hospital, and there was not much use finishing him off. So me and Pavarotti drive to 56 Hope Road expecting police, which means nothing when all you need is one shot. Besides, I make one phone call and the police would disappear in 60 seconds. Except 56 was a ghost town, not a single police. I laugh. Meanwhile, Peter and Nasser getting so sloppy that it looked like a TV show on how much mistake one man can make. That stupid piece of dog shit leave a message, a goddamn message with my woman that if the sage go on stage, it go and make the page and he'll be the rage. One of the few times in my life I ever hear Tony laugh out loud when I read the note. My woman didn't know what the rascal was going on, so she leave the two of us in the living room. I make a phone call. Where am I flying to? Bridget, what you call me for? I don't like repeating questions. Him gone. They leave the manager at the hospital and take him up to the White Man Hill. Police? One in the car with them. Few more back at the place. 12 tribes on the watch all over the hill. And a white boy. A white boy? A white boy with a camera. Nobody knows where he come from, but he said he's with the film crew. Anyway, me done talk. No, you no done talk yet, Inspector. Me done sing this Sankey. Done? Canary, you just start. Not even Jesus getting up that hill tonight. What about the concert? Full police escort to and from. What about the next day? I don't know. Talk. The next day I'm supposed to fly out. They have him on a private jet. When? 5:36. Morning or evening? What do you think? To where? Nobody know. So the jet going take off and nobody know where it going? Boss, you take get a man for idiot? Mister, me say nobody know. He don't even know. Not even the commissioner know. Is that top secret? It's a bigger secret than the color of the Queen's panties. We want to know because old man in the car with them pretend he gone to sleep and listen to them talk. Him white manager tell him up the hill that as soon as he done with the concert, they're leaving. Norman Manley or Tinson Penn? Norman Manley, overseas. You can radio the police up the hill. Yeah, man, but why would I radio the police up the hill right now? So 6 in the morning and the airport looking like the first reel of a cowboy movie. The only thing missing was Whistling Wind and Tumbleweed. Me and Tony Pavarotti waiting in a stairway leading up to the Waving Gallery. Somebody thought it was a good idea making this wall like a checker pattern with an open space to stick a rifle through. Checker pattern shadow leave we in the dark. Pavarotti was shifting and moving. He wasn't liking this angle at all. But the plane was already on the runway. Pavarotti is quiet, his right hand gripping the trigger, his left eye in the rifle lens. Way at the end of the runway, two jeeps hang back lazy, Jamaica Defense Force, with 4 or 5 soldiers behind them, two with binoculars. See them from the second I was in the Waving Gallery, soldiers on the hill looking out, making me think the singer coming down the hill. The look on his face when he wake up and see no police, I wish I saw. He probably send 2 or 3 Rasta Bridging ahead to make sure the road is safe. Save with he and his right-hand man coming down the hill alone. With no soldier watching through binoculars, you can assume 1 or 2 things about the police. 1, make a deposit to a bank account or a back pocket and anything can happen. And 2, they always come cheap. But with soldier, you never know. They hang back, standing, watch maybe. But maybe just waiting. Make sure you take him out before the soldiers drive over. Pavarotti nods. 6:02, everybody but the sun waiting on the singer. For a second, it feels like I'm waiting for a parade, like that grainy newsreel that come on TV every November about Kennedy in Dallas. Everybody waiting on the singer, not just me, not just the soldiers, not just Pavarotti or the plane, but Peter Nasser, Dr. Love, and a phone number for the Medellin drug cartel I never use. But then I wonder, is everybody waiting to see his next move or mine? Who is the real dancing monkey in this episode? Who people watching to see? And if people said jump and you managed to jump high, do they stop telling you to jump or disrespect you forever because you didn't act like a man and say, fuck you, go jump yourself? The problem with proving something is that instead of leaving you alone, people never stop giving you new things to prove, harder things, bullshit things until it become a comedy or just a joke. Tony Pavarotti tapped my shoulder. He's here. He and another Rasta walking to the plane. Nothing moving but the dust they kick up. The airport is still empty and not waking up till 7. They look around while walking, moving slow, stopping 1 second, moving again. The singer looked to the plane, scanning left and right, with the other Rasta walking backwards, making sure nobody following them. Both of them see the army jeep. The singer look at the jeep and look at the plane. Nobody move. Tony Pavarotti turning the gun to aim, following them. His fingers slip around the trigger. The singer looking at the soldiers and says something to the Rasta. They start moving again, but slower, stopping right in front of the plane. Maybe they're waiting for somebody to come out. I remember that Tony Pavarotti don't need orders from me. I hear a click. Stop. Pavarotti, look at me. Look at the two of them running to the plane now. Don't bother with it. They run to the plane and have to close the door themselves. When I get 2 phone calls the next day, I cut both short with the same line. You want him dead so much, you kill him. So, I'm going to read one brief scene that's set in America, actually. So, total change of pace. This is a character. Her name is Dorcas Palmer. She's a caregiver in New York in 1986. And this is her getting her new assignment. I'm just going to read a little part of it. All you need to know about Dorcas Palmer is that her name is not Dorcas Palmer. and this is her about to report for her new job. You know how them girls stay? Come all the way to America and still going on like them is some dirty whore from Gully. Me tired of them girls, so tell. Me tell this nasty slut who was working for Miss Calters. Nasty slut, me say. As long as you look at you working in this year job and living under that there roof, you better lock up that pum-pum, you understand me? Lock it up. Of course, the bitch never listened and now she's pregnant. Of course, Miss Calters let her go, on my recommendation, of course. Can you imagine some little stinking bottom pitney running rapid round the place on Fifth Avenue? No, Baba. The white people would have one of them white people things. I can nip chanterated. So does she go by Miss Calters or Ms. Calters? So does she go by Miss Calters or Ms. Calters? What a way you stosh us. Them going like you quick. Boy, sometimes me don't even know which. Soon as she start read some magazine named Ms., she says she named Ms. Calters, my love. Me just say ma'am. Ma'am, like some slavery thing. For once she didn't know what to answer. 3 years now, I'm with God Bless Employment Agency, and every time I come in here, she has a brand new story about some ghetto slut who got pregnant on her watch. What I don't understand is why she always feels I'm the person to tell these things to. I'm not trying to be understanding or empathetic. I just want a fucking job so that my slumlord doesn't kick me out of my top-class fifth-floor walk-up with a toilet that makes murder sounds when you flush it, and rats that feel I should sit up on the couch and watch TV with me. Trying to use them word around the cultures. New York people answer about them kind of remark. Oh. At least you have one of them Bible names they love on a Jamaican. Can you imagine? Last week, me get a man a job. Probably because him name Hezekiah. Who knows? Maybe they think that nobody with a name from the good book going thief. You're not no thiefing girl. She asks me this every week I come to pick up my pay, even though I've been here 3 years. But it looks like the Calters aren't the usual clients, clearly. Where's my 10th grade teacher now for me to tell her what doors I've opened up in life just by knowing how to speak correctly? Miss Betsy's looking at me. Some jealousy, sure. Some envy, too, because I have what beauty contestants call deportment. Pride, of course, because she can finally use somebody to impress the Calters. But pity, too. That one, most definitely. She wondering how a girl like me come to this. No, Miss Betsy. Good, good, wonderful, good. Don't ask me why I was walking past Broadway past 55th, because not a damn thing was going on that street or in my life. But sometimes, I don't know. Walking on a New York street, it doesn't make your problems easier or manageable. It just feels like you can just walk. Maybe I was just bored. People here with 3 jobs looking for a 4th, and I wasn't even working. So that meant walking. Anyway, walking down Broadway past 55th Street, looking out for freaks and flashers and everything I saw on TV, this little sign was sticking out between 2 Chinese restaurants on 51st, God Bless Employment Agency, which was enough to make it clear Jamaicans run it. But if that didn't do it, Then the proverb at the bottom of the sign, a soft answer turneth away wrath, which didn't have a fucking thing to do with anything, certainly did. The only thing left was to add international in the title. But I had some nerve thinking I could just start down to a place that existed for losers like me. After all, there are only so many times you could call your American ex in Arkansas and to ask for money to help him, for him to help you, and for him to say, fine, I'll send you some cash, but if you ever call my house again and threaten to talk to my wife, I'll make a little call to the INS, and you'll see if you don't find your conniving nigger ass on the next fucking flight back to Jamaica, catching one of those clear plastic bags they give deportees so everybody in the airport knows which brand MaxiPads you use. I didn't want to tell him that the word nigger didn't have quite the kick he was counting on, nor bitch, nor cunt, since Jamaican girls don't respond to those things. But yeah, I was in no position to walk past anywhere called employment agency. You know why I'm giving you the job? Because you is the first girl to come in here with some manners. Really, Miss Betsy? We've also had this conversation before. She runs an employment agency that places mostly black women, mostly immigrants, into posh houses to take care of their very young children or very old parents who have the very same needs. In exchange for us putting up with shit, sometimes literally shit, they don't ask questions about immigration or employment status and everybody wins. Well, two people win. I just collect the money. The first client she sent me to was a white middle-aged couple in Gramercy, too busy to notice their weak mother smelling like cat shit and talking about those poor boys on the USS Arizona. She was in a room by herself with a thermostat set at 50 degrees. The first time I met the couple, the wife didn't look at me at all, and the husband looked at me too long. Both wore all black and the same black round glasses like John Lennon. She just said to the wall beside me, "She's in there, do what must be done." For a split second, I wondered if they expected me to kill the woman. And what woman? In the room, there was nothing but pillows and a bed sheet heaped up on the bed. I had to come in closer to see there was a little woman in the middle of it. The piss and shit nearly made me walk out until I remembered the money orders were done coming from Arkansas. Anyway, I lasted 3 months, and it wasn't the shit. There always comes a point when you're living in a house with a man when he start to think he can walk around with no clothes on. The first time he do it, I could tell he was really hoping I'd be taken aback. But I just saw another old person to nurse. The fifth time, he said the wife was gone to her mother of veterans meeting, and I said, "So you need me to figure out where you've misplaced your drawers?" The seventh time, he jiggled it in front of me, and I started laughing so loud I hiccuped. The mother in the room started shouting, "What was the joke?" And I told her I didn't care. She laughed too, saying, "His father was just the same. Always putting on a show when nobody bought any seats." From that day, the mother was always sharper on me. She even developed a little sass. Too much sass for cocky jiggler. I quit before he fired me and told Miss Betsy, "Well, I will scoop up any load of shit. I will have nothing to do with a withered penis." She was impressed that I managed to stay in standard English the whole time, even when I asked if this was a whorehouse with granny care as a fringe benefit. "It must be Immaculate Conception High School you come from," she said. "Holy Childhood High School," I said. "Same difference," she said. Thank you.
That concludes the reading for this event. Up next is the conversation.
Well, I should begin by telling you, those of you who might not know, that when two writers get together, the one thing they are least likely to talk about is writing.
Oh, God. We're not going to talk about process?
No. Yeah. We're not going to talk about process. We're not going to talk about whether you use a computer or not.
What's my morning ritual?
Write in longhand. No. I have a couple of topics I'd like to get into, though, mm-hmm. and I think we can go in any number of directions.
Yeah.
When we deal with them. And at the beginning, let's talk about beginnings in a literal sense.
I was going to go, that sounds like a writing question.
We get to the middle and the end later, yeah. Okay, born in 1970, mm-hmm. graduated University of West Indies in 1991, and then got an MFA at Wilkes University in 2006. Mm-hmm. What were you doing between 1991 and 2006?
God damn it. You know, what are you, my parole officer? I always preface this by saying one of the reasons why I'm the worst person for careers day at high school is because I just kept shifting, so I've done pretty much everything. Mm-hmm. I think at that time I was in advertising. Mm-hmm. You know, I like to tell myself, well, Don DeLillo was in advertising, so I feel good. I was in advertising. I was in graphic design. I was babysitting reggae stars. I was like, I went to school with Sean Paul. Most of us were in the same sort of social circles, kind mm-hmm. of. So we ended up doing a lot of each other's work. Just because I wanted a graphic designer for free. Mm-hmm. But so I was doing a lot of that. The one thing, I wasn't writing.
Yeah.
I was doing copywriting. And the thing about, I think, and this goes for any creative person, I think you need to know who you are. Mm-hmm. If you're a copywriter or you're a writer doing copy. Mm-hmm. Either you're a graphic artist or you're an artist doing graphics. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And yet you need to know which one you are. Because mm-hmm. if you're a writer doing copy, then eventually you're going to have to leave. Mm-hmm. Because what happens is you're just writing by committee and writing by compromise day in, day out. And that's what I was doing for years. Mm-hmm. And I went back to writing just to have some place where the only person I had to please was myself. Mm-hmm. And so I ended up, just write. The first time I started writing fiction seriously, it was just to have something to do at night. I didn't know the saying then, but I it's so true now. Terry Tempest Williams says she wrote so she can have more than one life. Mm-hmm. And that really was the only reason I was writing, so I could have more than one life.
Because mm-hmm. the one you had was not exactly fulfilling.
It kind of sucked. Sucked on many levels. So that's what I spend. I really do look at it as a kind of wilderness years. Me and my friend Ingrid get into arguments because she says, but it helped shape you. And I was like, no, it didn't. It really didn't.
No, like, I know. I feel the same way about plumbing. when I was that age, I was a plumber who rode at night.
Mm-hmm.
And
that sounds kind of hot, though.
Huh?
Sorry, I was going to say
all right. I wanted to ask you a question that leads to, mm-hmm. because one rarely gets out of that period in one's life into a real writing life mm-hmm. without having mentors, without having mm-hmm. a figure or a clack of people.
Yeah.
Or sometimes it's a group, sometimes it's just an individual that... You can consider a mentor who kind of shows you the way in some way or other. Do you have that?
Yeah, sometimes it's group, sometimes it's people, and sometimes it's just a moment.
Yeah,
it's a big cliche, but you really can't underestimate the difference a day can make. Growing up in Jamaica and writing, I didn't have a lot of mentors. Mm-hmm. Unless you're on a university campus, and I was only there for 3 years. Mm-hmm. So most of that writing I was kind of doing in the dark. I'd have imaginary mentors, I'd just gobble up books on writing. So mm-hmm. like Stephen Koch, who used to head Columbia, mm-hmm. and so on, was pretty much my mentor because I'd just read that book, or Norman Mailer's A Spooky Art, or Dorothea Brandon Becoming a Writer, or even Aspects of a Novel. Mm-hmm. Even I still think Ian Forster is a snob first, novelist second. Mm-hmm. But so in a way, those guys were my mentors to begin with. Then, this festival, the Calabash Writers Festival, is where I met you the mm-hmm. first time. Mm-hmm. They had a workshop. And two people who were very instrumental in how I became a writer, one was Elizabeth Nunes, And I remember I showed her my first manuscript, just a scene, and she was like, "You're a pretty good writer, but you don't have a clue about women." Which is funny, considering I write female characters now. And I was like, "What are you talking about? I grew up with strong women. My mom is a cop." And I'll stop there, like, that means anything. My mom is a cop. And then she said something which, to this day, I still challenge people who have been writing for decades, and they still get stumped. I go, "But," she said, "how many women do you read?" And all I can mention were the dead ones. Yeah, sure. I can literally recite Pride and Prejudice. I wasn't reading anybody. She says, "That's your problem. You're not reading. You're not reading how women write, or women write. Not just how women write women, but just how women enter literary space." So I went on this season of, you know, Toni Morrison, Alice Walker, and Alice Munro, and Iris Murdoch, and so on, and. Just the idea, it sounds so elementary that you want to be a better writer, you should read more. And I can testify that nobody follows that advice, because I didn't. And so that, and then it was two workshops in 2 years apart.
Calabash, I might to say, is a great literary festival in Jamaica. That goes on just for a weekend or so. But it draws people from all over the country. They come in families, they picnic, they make a holiday out of the whole thing.
Yeah.
And then it draws all these incredible writers from North America and England, mostly Anglophonic writers.
Mostly, yeah. Back then they also had a workshop series. So the second workshop, in between the two work, funny enough, between those two workshops, I had given up on writing.
Oh,
yeah, and I had a huge purging ceremony of it too. I was going to purge myself.
What was the reason?
Because it was my first book, and I sent it out, and it wasn't until
John
Crow's Devil.
Yeah,
and it wasn't until I stopped and counted I realized I was rejected 78 times, and. I'm not sure what's worse.
That'll get a man down, yeah.
Well, I don't know what's worse, like constantly counting and adding it up.
Yeah.
Or, because I didn't do that. I just like send out four and I get four rejections. It's like, whatever, I'll just send out another four. So I don't know if it's worse to one day stop and go, how many of these have I sent out?
Yeah.
And then just check and realize, wow, 78. So in between the workshops, I'd just given up. On being a writer, I just stopped. I was like, if 78 people think this is bad, then it must be. And the second workshop, I ran into Kaylee Jones, who was one of your students.
Yeah, Kaylee Jones, yes.
Who's a great novelist. Her father was James Jones, who wrote From Here to Eternity, and she wrote a bunch of really great novels. And her mentorship was different. Hers was more sort of kicking the ass, like, go right, bring me this thing. I'm not leaving Jamaica until you find that book.
I should interject a little story, if I can, about Kaylee Jones and Marlon. Kaylee wrote me around this time, I think, and said, "I have found a most incredible writer. Wow. You're going to love him." but the story, why I knew Kaylee, she was in a class I taught at Columbia in the MFA program in 1982, I think. It was a great, great group of young writers. She was one of them. Rick Moody was another. Mona Simpson was another. Susan Minot was another. I was somewhat intimidated teaching this class.
And you're the teacher.
And I'm the teacher. And the first class I taught with them, I said, "You know, I don't know what you expect from me. I'm not going to be your editor. I'm not going to redline or blue pencil your manuscripts. I'm going to try," because I had never been in a workshop until I had to teach one. I hadn't ever taken a writing course or anything. And so I said, "I have to do for you what I think a mentor did for me." And that mentor happened to be a writer named Nelson Algren, who was a great novelist of the 1940s and 50s mostly. But he had taken me under his wing in my early 20s.
Yeah.
And I regarded him as the person who kind of showed me how to stand to the world as a writer. And that's sort of what a mentor does for you. an editor can do the blue penciling, mm-hmm. but a mentor shows you how to be a writer in the larger world, because
yeah.
nobody else is, your plumber father isn't going to show you, your father the lawyer cop yeah. isn't going to show you, your mother isn't going to show you. Mm-hmm. It's going to have to be another writer whom you respect yeah. his or her stance in yeah. the world.
I also think there is also, this is not necessarily a writer, I think there's also like the book or the poem or the work of art, oh, yeah. whatever. That kind of gives you permission to write.
Right.
I didn't come up with that. I think the first one I heard say that was Gabriel Garcia Marquez.
Yeah.
When he was talking about how Kafka gave him permission to write.
Yeah.
Not that he wasn't writing before. He was a journalist. He was writing before. Most mm-hmm. people are writing. But he read Metamorphosis, and he remembers being appalled by it.
Yes.
It's like people don't wake up and become insects. That's not how the world works.
Right.
And this is Marquez. So, think, if he had not read Kafka, he would have been a social realist, and that would have been awful. So he read it, but in between being really appalled by this or shocked, it just so shook mm-hmm. his status quo mm-hmm. that it gave him permission to write the kind of story that was always in the back of his head.
Right. It gives you permission to mm-hmm. go a little crazy.
Yeah.
Which no one else will give you. I'm going to continue further about mm-hmm. Algren, though, because mm-hmm. after that class, I went back to my office, and Kaylee Jones mm-hmm. came to my office, and she said, Professor Banks, I have to tell you, I'm Kaylee Jones. My father was James Jones, who was a great friend of Nelson Algren. And in Algren's later years, when he fell on hard times and my father had died, he came to live at our house out in mm-hmm. Long Island. And he became like an uncle to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I suddenly saw, wow, this is like DNA. There's a kind of yeah. literary DNA being mm-hmm. passed along here.
Yeah.
And I didn't think about it too deeply until after Kaylee wrote me about you.
Yeah.
Then I said, wow, this goes from Nelson Algren to me to Kaylee to you. So you're really my grandson.
I you know what? I think the audience picked up on that. I was like, it was at the very last minute I decided not to wear a white shirt.
Right.
But, you know, this is to come back to writing workshops, because, you know, I didn't go into a writing program until after my first book.
Mm-hmm.
And the main reason I went is because nobody's going to hire me without some degree. That's the only main reason. But I also think that in a lot of cases, that's the only place people are going to run into community. Yeah. And run into mentors. I don't think any community for the rest of your life. Actually, sometimes that can be a problem.
Because
I have students who still write by committee. I'm like, no, I'm not reading your work. Go out there and take your lumps and get a bad Michiko Kakutani review like the rest of us.
Yeah.
But also that's sometimes the only place you'll run into mentors, because you do need that.
Yeah, in my time, in my generation, in the 1960s, late 50s, you could find a community usually in a city.
Mm-hmm.
I found it in Boston in the late 50s, early 60s.
That's kind of shocking. Boston? What happened?
Well, there were at that time a lot of young writers and mm-hmm. musicians and artists gathered there. It was mm-hmm. kind of an extension of the beat movement, mm-hmm. San Francisco, Boston, and New York. And you could gather a group of like-minded young artists around you mm-hmm. and support each other and learn from each other. And
yeah.
It functioned more or less the same way as a graduate writing program mm-hmm. did in that sense, at least, in sense of a community.
Yeah, there are tons of writers in Brooklyn, but, I mean, they're so busy staring at their navels, I don't think.
Well, yeah.
They're really
or calling their agents.
Or calling their agents. I don't think they have time for that.
Yeah. Let's talk about something a little different. Mm-hmm. It's something that intrigues me and especially engages me with your work, because your work covers so much territory. I mean, historical novels set in the 18th century, a small village novel set in Jamaica, and then this expansive international novel.
Mm-hmm.
And all of it requires a certain kind of information that didn't come to you at birth or mm-hmm. in the copywriting office, certainly. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if you want to talk about how much research you do and what kind
sure.
of research, and do you have any kind of
principles that you apply in it?
I actually do tons of research, and then I also hire researchers, known as my students, going for extra credit. But I, you know, it's to the point where I'm not, two things that I nearly ended up in library sciences, and nearly ended up in linguistics, because I'm really deep down a serious nerd. But I love research, and I love firsthand information.
Yeah, I do too.
Like I want the sources that the journalists read came across to write their article. Not that I don't trust the article, I read the article as well.
Yeah.
I read the abstract. I'll read the first thing I go to when I pick up a history book is a bibliography.
Uh-huh.
It's like, that's great. I'm going to read the book, but I want to know your sources, and I want to read those first-hand sources, because I love research. I also, for me, research is such a huge, huge part of plotting a story, which seems weird because I don't expect it to. But then I'll come across something and I'll go, this changes everything.
Mm-hmm.
A case in point, I'm researching now how various African tribes name, how they come up with names.
Yeah, like days.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't know that. Yeah. And I'm like, wow.
Yeah.
That's 400 pages I'm going to have to rewrite. It can be frustrating. For example, when I was researching Nightwing, because I do a ton of research. Sometimes I do up to 2 years research before I write a book. And I'm sometimes researching as I'm writing.
Well, that's what I do a lot of.
Yeah.
Too. I divide research into two categories. There's front-loading and on a need-to-know basis.
Oh, that's what Jane Smiley does, too.
Yeah?
Yeah. She told me, research enough to write the first 200 pages.
I just do the first 100.
Yeah.
Yeah. Research enough to do it, and then go out when you need to know the facts. It's sort of, I learned that from watching American politicians who say, don't tell me anything I don't need to know. And Ronald Reagan was the master of that, I think.
You're saying Ronald Reagan is your mentor?
Yes. Yeah, but you can front load too much. I mean, you can become the master of the material and then lose the novel entirely in that.
Yeah, one, I fall into that because I also love to procrastinate.
Yes.
I don't know where I stand as a writer, but I am the greatest procrastinator of my time.
Yes.
I love to do it. But you're right. Like, that to me was my issue with, say, a John Updike novel like Terrorist. Where you can tell it was so meticulously researched.
Yeah, he had fun researching it.
Yeah. Yeah. But then the novel shows it.
Yeah.
But then he forget to bring a whole novel to it.
There's a point I know when it's, the Doctorow was asked, how much research do you do, Mr. Doctorow? And he said, just enough.
Yeah,
and,
it has been just enough. Yeah.
And that point I find for myself is at that point at which I start correcting the historians and correcting the experts, the people who've spent their life studying this material. And I just want to get some details. I want to find out, what did people eat for breakfast in December in 1889 in rural upstate New York?
Well, I can tell you that. I know that quite well. Yeah. It's what was I going to say?
I don't know. I want to talk about a couple of other things while we have a little bit of time left here. One was generated by a brilliant essay you wrote in the New York Times in 2015 about coming out and about the remarkable, dramatic, painful contrast between being gay and in Jamaica and the years afterwards when you came to the States to live. And there was in that there were a couple of phrases that just stuck out to me, and one is a painful one, where you say, whether it was in a plane or a coffin, I knew I had to get out of Jamaica. Mm-hmm. That's a desperate spot to be standing in.
And I think there are different kinds of desperation. Mm-hmm. I never faced any homophobic attacks in Jamaica. None of my friends did either.
Mm-hmm.
But that is almost beside the point.
Yeah.
It's the idea. It's the way in which the fear of it. It's not. It's the fear of it. It's like not the war, but the rumor of war.
Yeah.
there's a fear of attacks and a fear of reprisals and hearing things happening so close. Like there was right around the road from me was an AIDS support. And you know, a lot of Jamaicans still think only gay people get AIDS. So they thought it was this den of gay people and people just broke in a certain beating up everybody. Yeah. So it didn't happen to me, but it was close enough. And the idea that it could happen.
Right.
The idea that I was waiting for it to happen.
Right.
That, I think, to me, is what got really, really oppressive. The idea that it's not even an it. It's like when it happens. And, mm-hmm. and the way in which I've seen it in my gay friends in Jamaica, the way in which they don't realize just how much they've started restricting themselves.
Yeah.
Like the endless protection ritual you have to do just before you kiss somebody goodnight.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Like, are all the windows closed? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And if the windows are closed, oh, fine. Is the light off? Are they seeing a silhouette of us kissing?
Mm-hmm.
And just the very minute level in which that got started to just really, you know, paralyze me. I would sit down just in the dark, just going, what is going to happen to me?
You speak in the same essay about reading Rushdie's Shame,
mm-hmm.
and you call it a grenade inside a tulip, which is a memorable, nice phrase. And I wonder how that worked in that essay, the book Shame. I mean, what role did that play in
that
process?
It's funny, that comes back to the question that what we're talking before about giving me permission to write.
Yeah.
That was a novel that gave me permission to write.
Yeah.
That and another novel, Jessica Hagedorn's Dog Eaters. Well, we're talking about Shame. Because I remember being appalled by that novel when I read it. Again, growing up very British colonial, growing up with the social realist novel, you know, with Dickens and George Eliot and all these people who I still love. But, you know, he was talking to the reader. He was telling the reader who he's going to kill off on page 50. Mm-hmm. And I flip to page 50 and the person's dead.
Mm-hmm.
Making these huge character judgments, saying, what kind of hero is this? And I was like, you can't do that in a novel. You can't do that in a novel.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And of course, simultaneously going, but what if you could?
Yeah.
And I remember, because I was writing a novel when I was reading Shame, and I totally discarded that book and wrote John Crow's Devil.
Yeah.
And that's what that you know. But it also made me realize, and I said it in the essay, that the future was something you can write yourself into.
Right.
Whatever that skill it is you have, if you're a painter, if you're talented enough and desperate enough, or if you're hungry enough, then you can do it. I tell my students, I'm not impressed by time.
And I also read it in the essay as an emblem of courage, and it gave you courage. And that was why it was in an essay about the courage of coming out and what it took to come out, and that a book could do that, a novel could do that, not just for you, the writer, but also you, the man.
Yeah, and novels have always been doing that for me. Most of my courage, most of the bravery I get from novels, and from poetry as well, but primarily from novels, and not just what happens in a novel, but the fact that a person wrote this.
Right.
That it was that a person can overcome their literary taboos or can do a statement of bravery or whatever. I mean, just the fact of the, you know, it's not just Salman's novels, Jeanette Winterson's novels as well.
Right.
Sometimes it's just form that I know you could go back to the pre-literary kind of forms, that the things that you didn't think were literature, like oral tradition or just patois.
Exactly. Exactly.
You could go back and do it. And all of that, it's books that gave me most of the tools to write books. If that, you know, books, that's why I have a huge reading list when I'm writing, because books are continually, it's a continual process.
That's right.
They continue to teach me how to write books.
Right. It's the currency we use. Mm-hmm. We probably have time just to address one more topic.
Mm-hmm.
So this is coming to the ending. And we did the middle and we did the beginning and now the ending. This is the process part. and the ending is always the future. So what are you working on now? Where are you going from here?
Well, again, because I can't stay in one genre. I think I'm writing let's call it a fantasy novel. It's a fantasy trilogy I'm writing setting in sort of a late Iron Age Africa. So that'd be like maybe 600s.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, easy. I love the research for that was really easy.
Not much there, right?
No. Oh, God, there were tons. There was tons of stuff. It was so that's what I'm working on now. And I'm writing, it's a trilogy, but it's not really a trilogy. It's not a part one, part two, part three. Uh-huh. I've always loved Rashomon. I've always loved the Alexandra Quartet. So it's actually three novels that's telling the same story three times. It's uh-huh. just that these people have very, very different ideas uh-huh. about what happened. Uh-huh. So that has been a lot of fun to write, and also hard as hell because I had to invent. For one, it took me. I couldn't figure out how to get in the book, and this is a talk about process. I was talking to a producer, a director who wanted me to write a screenplay. And she was giving me the idea of how the screenplay, she wants the screenplay to take shape. And I'm in my head going, screw the screenplay, this is a novel.
Yeah.
So that's a novel.
Yeah.
This is just set in Africa. But the idea she gave me, how that was the way, that was the sort of eureka moment to enter that story.
Right.
Or those stories.
Right. Well, listen, we could probably go on for a lot longer, but I know our time is just about up. So I want to thank you all and thank the Lannan Foundation for bringing us here. I want to thank you, too.
Thank you guys for coming out.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.